Hello, and welcome to the episode 26 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, the podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I am formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. First, the news. I wrote a piece a few days ago about an alternative sentencing reform scheme that I thought up while making dinner. I was thinking two things. First, if the core problem with sentencing is racial disparities, then addressing racial disparities should be at the core of our sentencing reform schemes. Second, if the point of reform is to move from exclusively punitive to smarter models of criminal justice reform, we need to stop pushing for equally punitive sentences and start pushing for equally good outcomes. You can read more about this proposal and my thoughts on this. I'll add the link to that article in the show notes. We're also less than a week away from the premiere of season 6 of Orange is the New Black. As you may or may not remember, I have written recaps of every single episode of Orange is the New Black from the perspective of a formerly incarcerated person. For those of you who don't like the show, I am critical of a lot of the parts of the show, but I do think that it's one of the few shows that actually treats each of the prisoners with a modicum of human dignity, and the amount of human dignity that they afford each of the prisoners, to me at least, is greater than the amount of exploitation that the show engages in. Does that mean they get every detail right? Of course not. In addition, just to make things even more interesting this year, I'm going to try very hard to get comments from some of my friends who are women who have done time in order to get as many voices talking about this as possible and not seed the idea that this show is just about entertainment and that real reform things are not involved in the show. So look forward to that. I should get the first one out a day or two after next Saturday, which I believe is when the first episode comes out. I think that means I'll put out my first recap on July 28th, and I usually put out a new recap every week until the season's over with. Finally, I'm thinking about starting a criminal justice reform Twitter chat. If you're not familiar with Twitter chats, basically, the idea is once a week, people get together and talk about a particular subject. So I'm going to try to find a catchy hashtag and try to start bringing people together to talk about a different criminal justice reform topic every week so that we can all learn from each other's experience and share each other's wisdom. If this sounds interesting to you, tweet me about it with your ideas or leave comments about what you would like us to do or talk about at decarcerationnation.com. Please do share any thoughts you have. I think the more times we find ways to talk to each other, the stronger and better criminal justice reform as a movement will become. Okay, this week I'm putting the spotlight on all the great things that have been happening in the city of Philadelphia. To learn more, I could not have found two better guests than Reuben Jones and John Dye Harrell. So let's get to the interviews. My guest today is Reuben Jones. Reuben's Twitter profile says that he's a freedom fighter and social justice superhero. And after doing some research, I can't really argue with either of these titles. Despite spending 15 years in prison, Reuben earned a master's degree, is a practicing therapist specializing in trauma-based care and cognitive behavioral therapy. He's the founder of Frontline Dads and the Philadelphia campaign coordinator for Just Leadership USA. Reuben has been so central to the fights for social justice in Philadelphia that he has received about 100 awards, from what I could tell, for his work, most notably receiving a Presidential Service Award from President Barack Obama. It is my honor and pleasure to welcome Reuben Jones to the Decarceration Nation podcast. Hey, Reuben.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So do you mind going back in time a bit to the start? Can you tell us as much or as little of the story of how you ended up in prison as you would like to share?
Yeah, certainly. So back in 1986, I was around 22 years old. I grew up in North Philadelphia, and I was involved in a robbery that I was subsequently convicted for and sentenced to prison time. So I ended up spending 15 years in state prison in Pennsylvania.
Okay, and what started you on the path to transformation, or what did you learn through that journey?
It wasn't an immediate, you know, there was a learning curve. So when I first went to prison, I was dealing with the culture shock of actually being there and that sense of hopelessness of being behind this steel and concrete foreboding cage. And it took me a little time to adjust. Are you still dealing with the appeals process and just, you know, coming to the reality or the realization that you're actually in prison and you can't go nowhere. You can't go anywhere until you're released. So I was engaged in, you know, just trying to find my way, you know, and figure out why am I here and what really happened for me to make such a horrible choice that brought me to prison. So after about 4 or 5 years, I began reading and studying and, you know, just picking up any kind of literature I could. And I ended up joining this study group. And, you know, I was introduced to new ways and different ways of thinking. It made me hold myself personally accountable for the choices I made. And it, you know, allowed me to look at the consequence of those choices and realize that there was a consistent pattern with all those outcomes, which was me and the decisions I made and the thinking process that I had and how those things contributed to every negative situation that I encountered in my life from, you know, being fired from jobs to breaking up in relationships to end up, you know, being in prison. So that was the impetus. And as I really began to kind of do this, this journey of self-discovery and self-awareness, you know, I started to really kind of grow. I think I began to evolve little by little in that process until eventually, you know, I grew into a space where I wanted to help repair some of the harm that I had caused in my community. And that's what I committed myself to upon release. So, and that's what I've been doing for the last 16 years since being home.
So what was your reentry process like? Did you get, did some stuff, some of your future work come out of that process?
Yeah. So initially when I came home, I was in a halfway house and it was really hard. So what I would do was I would get up every morning. You know, we could sign out of halfway house. I got a little backpack. I would make me a couple sandwiches, throw a couple waters in there, and I would literally hike across the city just filling out applications. Like in every business that I stopped at, you know, I would ask them, you know, if they were hiring, if I could fill out an application, that kind of thing. I ended up taking a class at a place called the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which is a reentry program. So I did that program. You know, they helped me hone my resume. And, you know, I started volunteering there. And while I was volunteering there, there was a gentleman who worked there who kind of liked my story. And he asked me if I would be interested in sharing my story with some young people who were, you know, in the shelter. And I did. And I've been volunteering there ever since for the last 16 years. But as a result of that volunteer job at the Pennsylvania Prison Society, several months later, a job opened up there and, you know, I applied for it and that became my first paid gig after being released. In fact, I still have that, the letter, you know, the welcome letter when they officially, you know, offer you the job. I still have that letter as one of the mementos in my little keepsake box. Of all of my accomplishments since being home, that first offer letter carried a lot of weight for me. It was my first real opportunity to have a real job and begin to live out my dreams of being a free man who was a contributing member of society. So that was part of my reentry process. But socially and emotionally was another story. So I was, you know, it came from a place where, you know, everything was controlled movement. So I was on, I remember being on the subway and kind of having somewhat of a panic attack from just all the people in the uncontrolled environment. I remember crossing Broad Street right at Broad and Lehigh and, you know, kind of got stuck in between crossing with all this traffic coming in both directions at what seemed like a high rate of speed, you know, and I hadn't been used to things like that for so long. I remember being in the supermarket and watching people use the self-checkout line. And I really didn't know you know, what it was or how to do. I had never seen it before. I would just see people like kind of slide their goods across this glass, and it would beep, and they would put it in the bag. So I tried it, and it wasn't beeping for me. I didn't even realize that you had to scan the barcode. I thought it was just, you know, you slide the product. I didn't know, and I was standing there looking and feeling really stupid. You know, like I felt like everybody's gonna know I just came home from prison or something. Same thing with riding the bus. You know, I remember getting on the bus and going to the wrong places just because I thought that I was on the right bus. I mean, there were so many just transitional moments for me, learning how to navigate society again and learning how to read the terrain and get reacclimated. It was a tough job, even interacting with other people, whether it's on the job or in the community or, you know, trying to find a mate. It was very, very, it was a difficult transition.
So, yeah, I mean, I remember talking to a brother who was going home after, like, I think it was 25 years. And he was like, I'm really worried. I don't even know what this computer thing is. You know, when he went away, it was like rotary phones. So, you know, I mean, it's tough to, you know, when you've been gone for a long time to come back like that. And just for anyone who's listening who might not have the experience that we've had, controlled movement is just that when you're in prison, you're not allowed to basically walk where you want to walk. You have to kind of walk based on how they tell you and where they tell you you can walk. So can you tell me about how that all your experience got to Frontline Dads?
Yeah, so Frontline Dads actually, at least the premise of it started while I was still incarcerated. I was in a parenting program at the time. Just to take you back, so when I first got arrested, I had a son who was born 5 days after I got arrested, right. So less than a week. So I never had any contact with him. His mother didn't want to bring him into the prison. So for the first 9 years of his life, I didn't even see him. So eventually, we went back and forth a bunch of times over the years, and eventually I filed a petition in family court for joint custody visitation. So we went to court, and I won. So my family was allowed to serve as the proxy during my scheduled visitation time. So they brought him up to see me. And what I realized was that, you know, I didn't have any parenting skills. I never raised a child before. I didn't know anything about, mm-hmm. you know, children. And worst of all, how do I build a relationship with him from inside of a prison cell? So I joined this class. It was a parenting program to help learn some of those things I didn't know. And I eventually ended up becoming a facilitator in the program and served in that capacity for years. So some of the men that were in the program, what we started to realize was that there was a lot of men who were incarcerated, and they would see their fathers sometime for the first time, or their grandfathers. There were literally family reunions inside the prison. So sometimes you had two and three generations. Sometimes you had the whole families, uncles, brothers, cousins, nephews inside of prison. And most of these men were going home at some point. So we, you know, as men would come through the program and they improve their relationship with their children, with their families, inevitably as they prepare to go home, they would, you know, kind of want to come back to the program to get some advice or support for their ultimate release. So we decided to create something that would serve as a transition for men who were being released. And that's where Frontline Dads was born. So when I was released in 2002, I ended up bringing that premise home with me and built a foundation to mentor young people, to provide reentry support for men and women return home, and to continue to advocate for policy change for incarcerated folks across the board. So that's how I was born. But once I was home, I partnered with the Pan-African Studies Department at Temple University. I partnered with the Leon Sullivan Trust, and they served as a fiscal sponsor, and they provided office space and all these things. We taught the parenting class down at Temple. So we, you know, found all these wonderful community partners that allowed us to kind of bridge the gap into the community and provide a service to be able to support the folks that we have identified that may need some help. So, and we've been going strong ever since, doing everything from, like I said, mentoring young people to reentry to social justice advocacy, and we continue to grow.
And you're involved in some other organizations too. Do you want to just give me a kind of rundown? Because you seem to have a lot of, you're doing a lot of work, man.
Yeah, the one thing I learned as a young person, the idle time and idle mind is the devil's workshop. So I try to stay busy. I try to make sure that, you know, I'm making a contribution to society to make it better. So I'm a member of the No 215 Jail Coalition, which is right now the leading advocate to end cash bail in the city. I'm also a founding member of the Philadelphia Community Bail Fund, where we post bail for people who can't afford it, simply because we believe that it's wrong to hold people in jail and make them pay for their freedom.
Amen.
We're talking about pretrial detention where no one has been found guilty. And yet there, some people held as low as $200 and $300 simply because they can't afford bail. I'm also a member of the Coalition for Just DA, in which we got involved in this last DA's race, trying to find a progressive district attorney who would be willing to shift the tide, so to speak, in the criminal justice landscape in Philadelphia. And that person ended up being Larry Krasner. So now we meet with him regularly to hold them accountable to some of those campaign promises, as well as the overall vision for transforming the city. So yeah, I'm involved in a lot of stuff around social justice advocacy work. We just testified in front of the Sentencing Commission, who was wanted to introduce the use of risk assessment algorithms to the sentencing phase of the criminal justice process. So a bunch of us went down, they held hearings in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Harrisburg. A bunch of us testified, pushing back on that notion because those risk assessment algorithms tend to be racially biased, and you know, they use a static information that disproportionately impacts people of color. And already Philadelphia jails are filled with people of color at a 9-to-1 ratio. So we didn't want to support anything that would further contribute to that dynamic. So all of my work is around making our community better, making our city better, and making our politicians accountable to a premise of fairness and equity across the board in terms of criminal justice.
Did you say 9-to-1? That's high even for most of the country, which is already pretty high on the disproportionate scale for race.
Yeah. It's about 88.7% people of color
Holy.
Incarcerated in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is already the highest incarcerated city, big city in the country. So the United States is the highest incarcerated nation in the world. So that means Philadelphia is at the apex of incarceration. So we should be doing everything we can to change this craze and to really treat people with a sense of dignity and fairness.
Absolutely. So before I jump into some of the more specific stuff about Philadelphia, you were also part of a documentary called Beyond the Walls, The Road to Redemption. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that was a beautiful experience. Truly visionary by the theater witness, a woman named Taya Sapanovic. Hope I got her name right. Had this vision to bring people together who had lost children to violence. So most of them were mothers who lost sons to violence, along with men who had been perpetrators of violence and had been incarcerated. And there was a moving story of how communities can heal. Because when someone is murdered, obviously there's a loss of life for one family. And the other family is suffering, even though their son or uncle or cousin may be alive, their family is still suffering. And the families in the communities are who's left behind to pick up those pieces and to heal and to mourn. And this is a beautiful piece that they want to show that pain, but also want to show the hope that people can triumph by working together through forgiveness, through love, and through healing. And I think we were able to do that. We toured that for about, I think, 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. All over the country. It's a DVD. If you don't have a copy, I'll be happy to get you one.
Great. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it was just a beautiful piece of work. Every performance we did, people were in tears, and the documentary is something that really kind of chronicled that story and that journey. So, it was definitely a worthwhile endeavor for me to make a contribution to that. In fact, I was initially a little bit leery when they first approached me because I was dealing with mothers who, a lot of them still have fresh pain from the loss of their son. And I wasn't sure, how I would, fit into that mix. And then B, if the emotion would be too raw and they direct some of the anger towards me. But it was,
so how did you
navigate?
It was
a great experience. One of the people in it was a police officer. And she embraced everyone equally. There was no judgment. It was just all about healing. So yeah, it was a great project.
So how did you end up navigating in the short term, kind of the were there initial reactions that were negative to your participation with some people who had just experienced loss? Or
yeah, it was tough. It was tough because, you know, some of the mothers to sit across the table and be on the same stage with perpetrators of violence was a reminder, even though they know, you know, I wasn't directly responsible for their son's death, but I could have been, sure, because you never know. Circumstances, timing, whatever. And, you know, when they see you in that space, you know, they see you as the perpetrator who took their son's life. So some of the moments was difficult, but I think we dealt with it in a real diplomatic way and honored everyone's pain and honored everyone's hurt. We didn't shy away from what folks were feeling. They were allowed to just own their feelings and not, you know, have to, you know, make up for it. And that was beautiful. And I think it all came across on the screen in the documentary that a lot of the emotions were raw. People were crying, people were breaking down. And I think it added to the power of the film. So for me, I made some lifelong friends, some of the very women who, in fact, I just spoke with the police officer yesterday. This was 10, 11 years ago. We're still friends. I just met with the director. We're still friends. In fact, I've done another project with them since then. So yeah, it was difficult. It was challenging, but I think it helped everyone overcome some things that they were dealing with internally and helped to heal some of that hurt that they've been feeling on both sides.
And that's great too. It sounds like an incredible project. So lately you've had Philadelphia has had a string of incredible victories in criminal justice reform. How do you feel like the movement of all the different organizations and people started to come together in the beginning? Because I think for a lot of people, that's like the hardest part of getting real reform movements started. It isn't that there aren't a lot of people working on it. It's that everyone isn't always working in the same direction.
You know, I don't know if everyone is always, you said, moving the same direction, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if that's the case. I think that everyone has an agenda for, and I'll give you an example. I think Larry Krasner is a person who was a civil rights attorney who has a certain vision of how criminal justice should be dispensed. And we honor him for that. That doesn't mean we're always going to see eye to eye on every issue. In fact, we don't mostly. I think for me as a formerly incarcerated person, having, you know, seen some of that hurt, some of that pain from the inside, like I have a different vision. And I think for some of the community activists who've never been incarcerated, but they want to see a more fair, just world, they have a vision. Then you have families of victims and survivors who have a completely different vision. So I think the beauty of what's happening in Philadelphia is that we can be respective of those different perspectives while still working to change the system, make it better. Because there are people who have been victims of crime and violence and families who've survived crime and violence who still don't believe that the system treated their loved one fairly. And I'll give you an example. Recently, there was a person who was being released because the district attorney's office, Larry Krasner's office, discovered that there was some corruption in his case and felt that the conviction may not have been just. And the family, there was a backlash from the family saying that they hadn't been notified, they hadn't been consulted, and all these things. And while everyone would love to see a more fair and equitable system, if it's your son or your brother or your husband who was murdered, what you want is revenge. And what you want is to see is that person who inflicted that harm to feel some harm or to feel the sting of punishment. So there are different approaches. I think we all want the system to work, but how can you trust it to work when there's a list of police officers who the district attorney's office, I'm not talking about Kras, I'm talking about his predecessor, labeled as untrustworthy because of things like lying on the stand, things like manufactured evidence, and felt that they would risk their convictions if they call these people to the stand. How can you trust the system in which prosecutors have lied or hid evidence or didn't share exculpatory evidence with a defense attorney that they knew existed? So while we want a fair system, the reality is we know that all those convictions weren't fair. And as much as a family is hurting from the loss of a son, justice is denied if you don't incarcerate the person who actually committed the murder. And if you can't trust that that system was fair in dispensing justice, then how can we trust any of it? So I think that a lot of people come from different angles, different perspectives. They want to see, like, they're abolitionists. Or, you know, there's some people who just want to abolish prisons and not have them exist in our world. But there are other people who don't necessarily want to abolish prisons, but want to reform prisons. Then there are people who don't believe in reform and who just want to, you know, wipe the slate clean and start over with a fresh new system. So all those people have different agendas and they have a different, you know, direction or movement or plan of action. But the beauty is that we can all come together at the table and say, hey, what about this? Here's a point that we agree on. Do you agree that people should not be held pre-trial without being found guilty of anything in exchange for money? And once the answer is, yes, I believe that that shouldn't happen, then we have common ground to work from. So I think that's what happened. Even with the election of Krasner, I mean, there was an extremely diverse group of folks who came to the table, from the immigrant population, from the LGBT population, from the faith-based population, from the advocacy community, from the political community. And folks of all these different backgrounds came together and said, you know what? Our current DA is under indictment and sitting in jail. Right? Egg is on our face nationally, internationally. We want to make sure we get this right and get the right person in this office who can really bring a new kind of justice to Philadelphia, a new kind of fairness and equality. And the candidate we settled on was someone who had been fighting in the trenches for years, which is Larry Krasner. So for us, it just meant everyone putting their, kind of like when, I remember when they were creating We Are the World, Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson. Sure. He said they read us, they was, Quincy Jones had a sign on the door said, check your ego at the door. So you had all this room full of superstars creating this one song. And I feel like that's what happened in Philadelphia. People were able to check their egos at the door, sat around a collective table, and made a decision that was best for the city. And we put all our effort and support and resources behind that candidate because we believed he would be the best candidate to move the city forward. So that's how that happened.
Well, so everybody has probably heard of Larry Krasner. Is there anything else you want to share about either that process of him getting elected or what's happened since?
I mean, I think what happened with that process, people are probably going to be studying it for years and writing books and movies about it because it was a phenomenally organic process. Like I said, Seth Williams, who's our former district attorney, rode into town with a lot of popularity, with a lot of, you know, just fanfare, you know, a lot of hope, a lot of potential. But by the end of his reign, people were tired of him. You know, people had, you know, he was indicted. So he left a black mark on the city. So I think that contributed to folks wanting to wipe the slate clean and have a fresh start. I think what's happened since is even more phenomenal in that the same way Larry Krasner was able to push his opponents a little bit to the left on the campaign trail, I think his lead has actually made the city more progressive. Just with him leading the charge from an office like the district attorney's office to stand up and say, we're not going to pursue the death penalty. We're not going to ask for bail in for these 25 or 26 charges. We're going to support these juvenile lifers being released immediately with time served. So because he's taking such a strong lead and he's engaged the community from everything from town hall meetings to these kind of smaller group meetings that we do. And I think that his leadership has demonstrated that we could do things differently and the city's not going to fall. We could be more fair, more equitable to folks, and the city's not going to fall. And there's this old guard of police and politicians and even some district attorneys who don't believe in that message. It doesn't resonate with them. They still believe in, you know, being tough on crime, lock them up, throw away the key. They're the bad guys. We're the good guys. But guess what? Those people are slowly being weaned out of at least the district attorney's office. And then the other politicians and police officers across the city are looking up, seeing what a difference we can make. And at least from a financial perspective, are beginning to see that it makes sense to approach it differently and not just continue to throw money at a problem, but take some real bold steps to addressing the issues.
So you were the coordinator for the for Just Leadership for the Close the Creek campaign. So let's start talking about this for people who don't know. What is the Creek?
The Creek is actually a county jail. It's the oldest county jail in the city that's actively being used. So it's called the House of Correction, but it's nicknamed the Creek because it was built. It was built over a creek, you know, in 1874 when it was built. But also, when people go to prison, you know, they kind of, you are up the creek. So it has a dual meaning. But the reason why we wanted to close the jail back in around 2012 or 13, the city expresses interest in tearing the same jail down because they wanted to build a new one. So they wanted to purchase some land to build this new jail on. And the reason they cited was that, hey, the jail is old, it's dilapidated, it's a Civil War era jail. And we think that it should be gone. We agreed. However, we didn't think they need to build a new jail. So we pushed back on the building of a new jail. We opposed it. We fought with the city. We ended up winning. They didn't build a new jail in the city, but the old one remained. So now that they took that off the table, we went back to their original argument. Hey, remember you guys said that you wanted to close the jail. So since I guess 13 or so, we've been, you know, trying to educate them on how you could close it, how it makes financial sense, and why it's such an oppressive tool of mass incarceration. So around 15, we took city council members down to around 15 or 16. We took some city council members down to Washington, D.C. to look at their pretrial services. So they don't use cash bail in D.C. and haven't used it since the 90s. And it was a very robust pretrial service that they use, they've incorporated. So we've done everything we can to show them that there are alternatives to holding people accountable. We're not saying don't hold people accountable, but the alternatives to holding people incarceration, holding people in jail pretrial. So we've come to the point where at least the mayor has agreed in principle, and they've depopulated the House of Correction. So now it sits empty. Our next step is to have it demolished. The mayor believes that it's too cost prohibitive to demolish. So they want to repurpose it for some other usages. We disagree with that, but you know, that's still a sticking point. And the campaign, again, is a lot of coalitions involved. So you have Juntos, who represent immigration issues. You have, you know, No 2 and 5 and the DA's coalition, and, you know, Power, which represents the faith-based, who all kind of came together to be a part of this voice local to say, listen, we need this jail closed and we need it closed now. So we're setting a tone across the country. And this campaign, if I could back up a little bit, was born out of the Close Rikers campaign. So everyone's heard of Close Rikers, and it's been going on for years, and it's getting to a lot of publicity and a lot of airplay. Well, you know, the vision for coming down and supporting Phil Lawford to close the House of Correction, close the Creek, was born out of that. Just Leadership is a nationally recognized entity that wields a lot of power and casts a huge shadow in the era of criminal justice reform. So having them come down and kind of be our big brother, so to speak, and put resources on the table and hire people like myself and, you know, other folks that be a part of this campaign has made a tremendous difference because we've got a lot done in a short amount of time. So I'm proud to serve Just Leadership and to work with the leadership there and be the feet on the ground in Philadelphia, leading the charge to not only close this jail, but once it's demolished, we have our sights set on other jails around the city. There are five county jails in Philadelphia. And we think we only need two, a male and a female. And so we definitely have our sights set a little bit higher.
Yeah, I think people who listen to this podcast regularly know that a lot of the most egregious problems that, I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens in prison, but jails are a lot, oftentimes even worse than prison. So anyway, what are some of the lessons that you've learned through the process of the Krasner and the Close the Creek campaigns that you could share with other activists to maybe help them kind of do, you know, kind of move through the processes that you've gone through maybe quicker?
I mean, the first thing I'll say, you have to build a strong ground troop. So that's coalition building. That's collaboration with folks. You can't just have a one-sided battle. So it can't just be formerly incarcerated people. It can't just be social justice advocates. You got to have a cross-section of folks. So we are partners with the ACLU. We're partners with the Defenders Association. You know, we're partnered with all these entities who believe in particularly with the faith-based initiative, because they wield a lot of power in the city. So when they stand up and say this is wrong, it becomes not just a legal matter, but a moral conviction for people to rethink their positions. So I think we've done that to a T, and part of going back to Krasner, part of that whole campaign kind of set the table for that. And it may sound too simplistic to just say people need to work together, but that's the reality. People have to come to the table before any of these campaigns kick off and hash out whatever the differences may be, but also focus on what the mutual interests are. We know that immigration is a huge issue right now in this country. But guess what? Criminal justice plays into immigration, because when we have immigration detention, when we have children separated from families, that becomes problematic. And the optics of it, you know, isn't great. So so we have people from the immigration community at our table leading discussion about specific things as it relates to people who are being detained through immigration. So I think the first thing is just to collaborate and have a cross section of folks at your table to lead. That's number one. Number two, I definitely think having a long term vision is important. So for us, the House of Correction is a part of a long term vision. You know, we need to decarcerate. That means close jails across the city and across the state, and put the money, the billions of dollars that's being spent, back into the communities that's impacted by mass incarceration. And we believe that those communities will thrive. Can you imagine if we put $2 billion, you know, back into North Philadelphia or South Philadelphia, or West Philadelphia, the impact it have on that community? And that's exactly what we're saying. When we take those resources out of those communities, the men are out of those communities. Philadelphia closed 23 schools, right? But we're spending $2 billion a year on incarceration. Like, that's absurd to me. So we have to reverse that trend and invest in communities and not continue to build prison. So having that long-term vision, I think, is important for a campaign. And then the other thing is you have to build relationships, because as much as we may disagree with city government and their approach, we're all residents of the city. So we have to be able to work with them. We have to be able to communicate. We have to be able to sit down and meet and have civil conversations, and not just, I mean, we could be out here protesting and chaining ourselves to stuff and tearing the city down. But at the end of the day, that's probably not going to get us the, you know, to the goal that we want to get to. So we have to be a little bit more diplomatic in our approach. Sometimes it's give and take, but ultimately we're going to get there. So that would be a key element, I would say.
Okay, so just two more questions. The first one I ask everyone, which is there anything else you'd like to share or anything you'd like to talk about?
I mean, I just think it's a beautiful time to live in Philadelphia. It's a beautiful time to live in this country where people's interest in social justice issues are peaked even more, particularly with, you know, the anti-45 sentiment and the things going on around the country. I think we see more activism now because people are more acutely aware of the need for us to lock arms together as brothers and sisters, as human beings. When we become desensitized to the plight of others, then we become less interested in supporting their causes. And I think what we're beginning to see is people who were disconnected yesterday are now forming bonds of brotherhood and sisterhood today because they're beginning to understand just what a formidable foe we are dealing with and how easy it is to get caught up in the hoopla of that's not my problem or that's not me. But I think we see people who are giving up careers and people are moving from suburbia into the city or dropping out of college to pick up this fight. You know, people are, you know, walking away from corporate America. People are, you know, doing some, you know, really sacrificing to be a part of this movement. And I appreciate that. I just want to say thank you to all those folks who see the value in really connecting human to human and saying we have to do something different. We have to make a change. So I think that's a big part of where we are right now. Just this whole groundswell of opposition to anything that attacks our humanity, and that includes mass incarceration.
So you talked earlier about, and this will be the last one, you talked earlier about your box of mementos. What was it like to get an award from President Obama?
It was surreal. It was surreal. So even though I cherish the award, that day was crazy because so when you go to the White House, you have to go through these checkpoints. And of course, everyone has to be cleared and all these things. So as I'm outside the White House gate, we're going through this checkpoint to go into the security office. And all of a sudden, about 15 or 20 or more guys dressed in all black with like automatic weapons come running out. Everybody get down on the ground. And as luck would have it, this is the day that a person had tried to jump over the gate. And they shot him and subdued him. So, of course, they had to, you know, whisk him to a secure location and all these things happened. But one of his deputies or whatever ended up coming later and did like this unofficial gathering and gave us the award. So that kind of put a damper on the day, but I still have the award. So I didn't get to actually meet him and, you know, get that photo op and shake his hand. Because someone decided to jump the White House gate on the very day. You talking about stealing Mike's thunder, man. It was crazy. But yeah, it was an honor, like just to be recognized like that, to know the president knows my name, to know that he values the work that I do and the contributions that I've made, even though I had a scarred background, to rebound from that and to become someone that's considered an asset to the community. I'm extremely proud and my mother's extremely proud. And I think that'll always be the proudest day of my life, other than the birth of my children and marry my wife.
Well, thank you so much for all the work you're doing, and what you and everyone else in Philadelphia have been accomplishing has been incredible. Really appreciate you being on the show, Ruben.
Thank you. I appreciate that too. I look forward to continue to build with you. You're doing a great job as well. And I just appreciate you for amplifying the voices of those folks on the front lines doing this work. So thank you.
Thanks so much, man. Have a good one.
All right. You too.
Bye-bye. My guest today is J. John Dye Harrell, a a formerly incarcerated activist from Philadelphia. Mr. Hurrell is a former Just Leadership USA Fellow, an important leader in the criminal justice reform movement in Philadelphia, and the co-founder and director of the Center for Returning Citizens. He has described himself as a doer in a city of talkers. Welcome to Decarceration Nation, John Dye.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
Oh, we're very, very happy to have you. I always like to start at the beginning. Can you share as much as you would like to share about your story?
So I am a formerly incarcerated person. We refer to ourselves as returning citizens, and I've done 25 years in the federal sentence, and that is two separate sentences, one of 16 years, which I did 7.5 on, and one of 20 years, which I did 18 years on. So I've served 25 years in the federal system. I came home in 2009, intent on moving my transformation from inside to outside, and I founded the Center for Returning Citizens, which is a nonprofit organization that seeks to attack mass incarceration on many different levels.
So when you were inside, can you talk about what led you to the mentorship of Dr. Shakur?
Yes, I met Dr. Matula Shakur in Lewisburg Penitentiary. He was working in a law library. I was working in the regular library, and I met him and was very impressed with the fact that whatever institution that he is sent to forms a core of progressive thinking prisons around him that we came to call the circle of consciousness. I made his acquaintance in Lewisburg, and shortly after that, I was put in the hole for a year for leading a work strike against the crack law, and I was sent on an administrative transfer to USP Atlanta. About 4 or 5 months, he was sent there also, and we began a 12-year association across three separate penitentiaries and magnificent work behind the wall.
You just brought up something that I talk about quite a bit on this podcast, which is solitary confinement. Did you do a lot of time in solitary?
I didn't do a lot. I would say in 25 years, I may have done 2 years total. The only time that I was in solitary was for activities that were construed as organizing. The prison authorities really don't like for prisoners to organize themselves in opposition to their authority.
Absolutely. So at what point did your consciousness change? I assume when you first got to prison, you hadn't really entirely changed your mind about everything that happened. Was there some event or some things that happened that got you to the point where you wanted to start working to make the system better and make yourself better?
Yes. In my first period of incarceration, I was mainly concerned with getting done my time, coming back home to my family, and resuming my life. At that time, in the federal system, you did 1/3 of your time, went to parole, and you came home. So it was a different focus. And I was younger. My children were younger, and I was intent on getting back to them. My second period of incarceration, I received a 20-year sentence, of which I had to do 85% of my time. So I was looking at a flat 18 years of incarceration. And that's very daunting when you first begin it. You're literally saying, how am I going to stay sane? How am I going to maintain myself? How am I going to move myself through 18 years of incarceration? So my thought process was, after I really did a lot of self-evaluation and decided that I needed to be a different person, was how was I going to transform myself into the person that I believed I could be, and what positive elements in the jail could I align myself with to facilitate that? And that's basically when I met Dr. Matula Shakur and began to do more reading, researching, and just looking at how I could become a better person, impact those around me, and prepare myself for freedom, even though freedom was 17 years away.
Okay. So you start this, eventually, once you get out, you start the Center for Reentry. But before you did that, was there anything in your reentry experience after either bit that led you to creating the Center for Reentry?
Yes, the Center for Returning Citizens was a thought process that I thought about inside. I didn't really have a clear vision of what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to create a nonprofit that could assist those who were outside, but also reach back to those inside. When I came home in 2009 and I encountered the halfway house system, I was so disenchanted with the work ethic and attitude of those who were given the responsibility to help us transition, I said, I know I can do this better. I know I can do it from a perspective that is holistic and it really targets our real needs and that it cares about those who are coming home.
And so could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by a holistic approach and your philosophy on reentry?
So most of the halfway house systems simply focus on you being housed and you find a job. And the halfway house system that I was in wanted you to find a job within 30 days of your being there. You're supposed to be in halfway house for 6 months, and they want you to find a job in the first month. And after the first month, every 15 days, you received an infraction report if you hadn't found a job. So they want you to find a job, begin to pay them 25% of your salary, and then they put on an ankle bracelet and they send you home. And they then, but for the full 6 months, you have to pay 25% of your salary to them, even though you're at home. You know, so what they're actually doing is over the course of 6 months, you might have three or four people literally paying for the same bed space. So it's a racket, it's a hustle. And there's no really conscious thought given to how you're going to structure your life and what you're going to. Well, I had spent 17 years planning how I was going to transition, and I had a serious idea of what I wanted to do, how I wanted to do it, and I could get no help from the halfway house system. So I began to think, how can I create a better organization that really looks at the needs of men and women as they come home and addresses those needs?
And what all do you do now that was different than what they were doing?
So we do look at employment. We do look at housing because housing is essential. But first we look at relationships. We look at family reintegration, how you can build a support system to maintain yourself and deal with the level of frustration and negativity that you're going to encounter as you transition. And that's for everybody. No matter how much you have worked on the inside to transform yourself, when you come home, you're going to face barriers in housing, barriers in employment. You're going to be looking for services to move yourself forward. And you have to build a support system to navigate that. So at the Center for Returning Citizens, whatever problems that a person comes through our door with, we try to address. If they are a man who is attempting to reunite with his family, provide a level of support for his children, whether he and his former wife or girlfriend are still together, we deal with that. If it's a woman who is trying to find housing, find employment, and get her children back from DHS or any kinship care provider or from her family who may have assumed responsibility for it, we deal with that. Whatever problems a person has, if they want to go to college, if they want to create a new vocation, we help people to create a life plan that fits their situation, that's realistic, that they can attain and move themselves.
Have you found any way around that halfway house hustle that you were talking about?
No, that's well, the state has begun to address that. And in Pennsylvania, the Department of Corrections is beginning to implement a system where instead of sending people to halfway houses for long periods of time, they are giving them a voucher for 6 months of apartments. You know, so you hit the halfway house, find a job, get the voucher, and you can take the voucher to a landlord, and your first 6 months rent are paid in advance is much more realistic. The problem with that is that during that period of time, a person should be saving and preparing themselves for when they start paying rent. Unfortunately, although they provide that service, they don't provide the necessary soft skill training so a person can navigate that period of time and then make to pay rent successfully. So unfortunately, some landlords that I talk to say that after that first 6 months, they have a very difficult time getting rent from people, and eventually some folks are being evicted.
Yeah, you brought up something that's I talk about a bit, which is soft skills training. I've always thought that it makes a lot of sense for a soft skills training to start inside prison in addition to other forms of training. We've had a real hard time having that discussion here. Have you been able to have that discussion with your Department of Corrections there?
Well, We just recently got blessed to get a contract with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation, and we go into South Mountain Security Unit, and we have created a 24-week curriculum that speaks to soft skills training, that does time management, critical thinking, that ethics, and tries to create a pathway so that the young people whom we are interacting with begin to build habits and build cognitive thinking patterns that enable them to be more successful when they come home, and that also tries to impact some of the negative behaviors that led them to their current situation.
Awesome.
And we're hoping that the Department of Corrections, in evaluating our work, will extend a contract to us to do case management when they come home, because as well as you might do inside, you're in a protected environment. Mm-hmm. When you come outside, good intentions don't always translate well unless you have positive case management and a support system that can help you to move that.
That's awesome, man. I'm glad you're doing that work. I also read something in one of the articles about you that says that you're building a kind of new microeconomy in Philadelphia called The Village. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Village is a concept at present that we're trying to push forward. Many people say that it takes a village to raise a child, but we believe that it takes a village to build a community. And one of the key components of criminal injustice, mass incarceration, is the inability of the poor Black and brown community to build an economy that they control. In our neighborhoods, the stores, the warehouses, most of the businesses are controlled by people who don't look like us, people who are not of our culture, people who don't hire us or our young people, and our dollars don't stay in our community for any length of time. In many communities, the dollars circulate 8 to 10 to 15 times before it eventually leaves the community. In the Black and brown community, it tends to be gone within hours. So we're not building systems that employ us, that employ our young people, or that bring wealth back into the community. So we are looking at how can we change the hustle. So with Frontline Dads, Ruben Jones, and we have...
Yeah, I talked to him last week. It was great. Yeah.
We created a program called Change the Hustle, which seeks to take the same skills that formerly incarcerated people displayed when they were hustling, when they were selling drugs or doing fraudulent criminal activity, and show people how they can take that ingenuity and use it to create business systems. Then we are trying to encourage institutions to look at us in a different way, to extend credit and resources so we can build businesses, so we can employ ourselves, so we can employ folks who are coming out of the system, and also employ our young people who need our guidance and direction.
Awesome. It's really, have you seen a lot of progress, or are you starting to see some progress around that?
Yes, we're definitely starting to see some progress. We have folks who have started businesses. We're in the process of creating several sustainable businesses, and we are talking to investors, and we are also, as a part of the Coalition for a Just DA, we worked on the Close the Creek campaign, which was a campaign to close the House of Corrections. It was the oldest prison in the city of Philadelphia, which was built in 1874, rebuilt in 1925, and had become a derelict structure that needed to be closed. And we waged an intense campaign to close it. And now we're looking to push Mayor Kenney to take some of the funding that was allocated to that to redirect it to returning citizen-led organizations. And to, in Philadelphia, several years ago, they closed 23 public high school and middle school, while simultaneously our state legislature allocated $400 million to two new prisons. Huh. And that clearly showed that their focus was incarceration instead of education. Well, we would like for the city to give us one of those schools so that we could turn it into a magnet center for organizations that are entrepreneurial or nonprofits. This would be the first center where we could test the strength of our ideas and our philosophy.
So it's kind of like an incubator.
Yes.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. As you mentioned, things have been pretty crazy in Philadelphia over the last few years. You all were able to elect one of the most forward-thinking prosecutors in the United States, and you also got agreement to close one of the most notorious jails in your area. I know for a lot of people in different parts of the country, sometimes the hardest thing is, and I was even reading James Forman Jr.'s book just earlier today, where it talked about even back to the 70s, this was a problem. Getting, you know, a lot of times when things are happening, it's really easy to mobilize the other side, but it's really hard as a general rule to get families and formerly incarcerated people out. What did you all do differently that's helped you have such success in your area?
Well, I think that one of the first things that we did, we had very strong organization. When I talked about the closing of the schools in Philadelphia while the budget was being created for the prisons, 2014, when that happened, we had a march through Incarcerate PA. We physically marched from Philadelphia, Love Park, to the Capitol in Harrisburg. It was a 10-day march. And as we marched through rural Pennsylvania, we handed out leaflets and we really talked to the residents. And when we got there, we not only had a rally on the Capitol steps, but we visited every legislator in the Capitol building. And that 10-day march, I really believe, was the beginning of a strong sense of unity between many different diverse organizations who were part of Decarcerate PA. And out of Decarcerate PA came the Coalition for a Just EA, came the 215 Cash Bail, CADB, which is an organization dedicated to life. So many organizations over the years had come to this work with a true sense of unity and with a sense of how can we create change. And we really worked hard to not only focus on the principles we believe in, but doing work in the community, doing the serious work that impact our people, but also advocating, proposing legislation, blocking legislation that we feel is negative to our community and to our population, beginning to build a political base. In 2017, we incorporated the Block Party, which is for Build, Lobby, Organize, Campaign, and myself and Anthony Dickerson co-founded that, and it's the first political action committee for only incarcerated people. And we believe actions like this we are putting the system on notice. We're going to be active politically, in a community sense, the things that we feel are negative, and continually push for change.
So, I mean, there's a lot of us out there, and that was it does sound like a really great strategy to get a lot of the people who are active out there and marching, so it creates that sense of unity. Was there any techniques or tools that you used in particular to reach the people who are still keeping their heads down or not being involved?
Well, we did a lot of door knocking in campaigns, and we especially try to focus on recruiting people from specific neighborhoods, because if you do like Bernie's people did and just send a bunch of young white college kids into our neighborhoods, they may get a little traction because of the message that they are pushing. If you can get friends, neighbors, community members excited about change, knocking on doors and talking to people who they've known all their lives, if you can get returning citizens in many neighborhoods are known to be ex-gangsters who have changed their lives, and in particular, for the DA's race. When we had returning citizens knocking on the door, telling their neighbors, we need to vote for this DA. When to many of us in the Black community, the DA has always been the enemy to our neighborhood, it left a powerful impression. Who is this guy who has inspired these people to campaign for him? When you look at specific issues like Close the Creek, and so many people have had fathers or brothers and cousins who spent time in the creek, and now this prison is being closed. When you look at so many of the things that the Krasner DA office has begun to implement, and people see it and they start to believe that a change is possible, it reinforces things.
So I promised we would talk about social media. We both have a passion for social media too. So can you talk a little bit about how you use social media in your campaigns?
When I came home in 2009, I knew very little about social media. I'd never been on Facebook. I never, Instagram, Twitter wasn't as strong then. But I have grandkids, and grandkids get you up on so many things.
Sure.
And it's like, no, Pop, you do it like this. And this is how you expand your base, you know? And I've got 14 grandkids now and 6 godkids, and they were amazing. So what I think that social media does, it allows you to impact and have conversations with and influence so many people outside of your immediate social circle. And you can have 5,000 Facebook friends. You can have as many Twitter followers or Instagram followers as you can move forward. So we use social media to raise the questions, to propose ideas, to debate. I found that social media enables you to instantaneously reach so many people, begin to have conversations that really promote.
So I apologize for doing this, but I asked you if you could do a little homework and put together a list of some of the tactics on social media that you've considered the most successful or powerful in the campaigns you've worked on. Can you share some of those?
Sure. One, we've always opposed things that were negative in our community, even at the risk of our own personal credibility and opposing those in power. I'll give you an example. In Philadelphia, Seth Williams was our DA, and so many years he was a terrible DA. As an individual and as the Center for Attorney Citizens, I used to stand in front of his office and make videos against him saying that he had to be run out of office. And while I was doing it, folks were telling me, how are you doing this? I mean, he's the most powerful politician after the mayor in Philadelphia. He's going to investigate you. He's going to blackball you. There's going to be no funding for TCRC. Well, my response was, the city isn't giving us any money at all anyway. So why am I worried about what the city's going to do? And what he was doing in terms of the fight against juvenile lifers, treatment of Umi Abdul-Jamal, the treatment of thousands of prisoners in the DOC who had hepatitis and they were not being taken care of, and also imprisonment and the attacks against black politicians who he was prosecuting for minor crimes had to be called out. So later on, when it was discovered that he was taking bribes and doing all manner of things behind the scenes, I was vindicated. But it was having the moral courage to say, this is an issue that we're not going to compromise on. And we do that in continuously many different instances, irregardless of how it is perceived by the public. Many times you can take a safe position, or you can say, no, this is wrong. We have to speak out about it. And I think in social media in particular, that has to be done. There's been times when I've opposed the Black Lives Matter movement because I do not agree with some of their tactics and some of their basic philosophy. And that's caused a controversy on here. It doesn't matter. What matters is you speak on what you believe and you stand behind it. And not only that, you are a beacon of hope and a role model in your community that can be looked at. Always be on the side. So I think that's extreme.
So were there any other tactics you've used that you thought were particularly successful?
Yes. Organizing with other organizations to run social media campaigns. For social media, key is getting into as many social circles as possible, and linking ideas so that it becomes a movement. And very successful in doing it.
And do you do that by just coordinating messaging or hashtags or both? Or do you set out kits or?
Hashtags, messaging, having organizational meetings. When you're a community activist, a large part of your work is organizing, having meetings with different organizations, different individuals, so that you can craft a message. One of the things that we have to realize that made the Republican Party and platform so powerful is they crafted messages, stuck to their messages, and moved it forward. On the left, Democrats and as progressives, we don't always do a competent job of first coming together and agreeing what are the most important messages and what should we be pushing at what times and how we can coordinate it. We tend to be all over the place instead of focusing on core messages, core issues, and really following through on. And we've been blessed to have progressive minds in our city who come together, put their egos aside, and coordinate messaging and that are effective. It was especially evident during the Krasner campaign, Close the Creek campaign, and the push for cash bail, which is really massive when you think about it. If we cash bail in the city of Philadelphia, that's so dramatic and dynamic, and it's going to impact so many lives. And we're very close to accomplishing that simply because we have had immense amount of organizational meetings, did the work behind this, and we built the relationships in city government, in state government, among stakeholders that make these victories possible.
So the last question I always ask everybody is there anything else you would like to share that I haven't asked you about already?
I think I'd like to say that the struggle against mass incarceration is $185 billion a year business. When you add all of the collateral finances, that we are battling this behemoth with volunteers, the churches, with college students, with the LGBT community, returning citizens. And it's essential that people support us on first with resources. Go to our website, tcrcphilly.org, and help us to finance this. If you're in Philadelphia, attend our meetings of the various organizations, come to our rallies, come to our events, wherever you are, because I'm sure that...
Yeah, that just fuzzed out, so if you could repeat that last part.
I said, not just in Philadelphia, but wherever you are, look at progressive elements in your community and give your time, give your resources, give your dollars so that struggle against mass incarceration and the fight for social injustice can be. We encourage, we've done so much with volunteers, with students, with those who are dedicated to this, but so much more, especially in terms of raising funds and so we can actually do this work. You know, so again, I'll say, you know, go to tcrcphilly.org and support our.
Well, I really want to tell you how much I appreciate you doing this. I really have enjoyed the conversations, and I just am so impressed with what y'all are accomplishing in Philadelphia. So thanks again for coming on Decarceration Nation.
Thank you. I really believe that in Philadelphia, we are at the forefront in the struggle against mass incarceration. The ideas and the work we're doing here can and should be replicated across the country. We're willing to travel to any city that would host us to show them what we're doing here and how it can be started or moved forward in their own city.
Awesome. I can definitely hook you up with some of my friends in Detroit and here, and we'll try to make something happen.
I got some family in Detroit. I'd love to come out.
Oh, awesome. That'd be great. All right, man. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Take care.
All right. You too. Okay, now my take. Part of the mission of this podcast is to raise up the voices of people who are doing the hard work of radically reimagining our criminal justice system all over the country. Hopefully, I can let people share their stories, the work they are doing, and we can all learn from the many exciting things they are accomplishing. I was inspired and learned a ton from my two guests this week, Ruben and John Dye. What is happening in Philadelphia should give us all encouragement. And what these two guys and so many of their brothers and sisters have been doing should inspire us all. These guys both got released from long prison sentences, started their own organizations built around reentry models, got involved in every other campaign and organization they could join, worked hard every single day to help other people return from prison to a better place, and eventually they became involved in bringing a new kind of prosecutor to power and also closed a notorious jail. I loved what Ruben said about making sure to bring everybody to the table and working to find unity of purpose to create the kind of numbers necessary to create real change. I love what John Dye said about walking across the state with hundreds of his sisters and brothers to forge the kind of links that never break, the kind of unity that can carry criminal justice reform past the finish line. We all need to find ways to create these kind of links with each other if we want to win. We need each other if we want to win. Right now, there are thousands of criminal justice reform organizations, tens of thousands of activists, millions of incarcerated people and tens of millions of formerly incarcerated folks in this country, but we are not unified and we don't always turn out in numbers. In fact, we don't always agree about everything, but we need to learn everything we can from each other and from each other's experience in order to make real and lasting criminal justice reform happen. I was watching the movie Sorry to Bother You this week, a really interesting and somewhat surreal movie that I really enjoyed, but it got me thinking about the cynicism that surrounds us and about how we could create a new politics and real change. It is definitely true that most people don't believe that getting together and marching around or calling your congressperson is the answer, that change will come from that. But I do believe that if 100,000 people are marching around and calling their congressperson, that does create movement toward change. When we can, we need to embrace each other, work together, and turn out in numbers. We need to reach out to other groups that wouldn't normally be allies, but where we can see common purpose. We need to join together and try to make real and lasting change. Thanks so much to Ruben and John Dye for joining me from Philadelphia to share their wisdom and experience, and for doing the great work that they are doing to help people who are coming home. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. That's all one word. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.